Welcome to A Moment with Modern Mentors, a podcast series by Digital Collective Co., where we soak up wisdom, anecdotes, and actionable tips from Australian startups, female founders, business leaders, industry pioneers, and C-suite executives. In season three of A Moment with Modern Mentors, we go behind the scenes. We ask our guests what it takes to be a leader. Not just the gloss and the glamour of leadership, but the setbacks, the failings, the insecurity, the stories that make up the person that they are today and what it took to get there, the hard work, and then the reward. We can't wait to share A Moment with Modern Mentors behind the scenes. Stay tuned for all the episodes. Hi, Carla. It's so great to have you on the podcast. Do you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Carla from Carla Middleton Architecture and CMA. We're an architectural practice of five in Sydney's beachside suburb of Clovelly. We practice architecture ranging from really boutique, beautiful apartments to really high-end residential homes for our clients. That's us.
And you're in a very beautiful location right now. I'm assuming this is your work. People are listening on audio. I'm not going to see it, but you can jump on YouTube and have a look at the actual full-length video, but you've got a magical setting. Tell us about that.
So this is the Tama House. This is the main living area, which features a central void with a skylight above, flooded with northern light. And here in Sydney, we're having a rainy day, so you can even see the beauty that is a nice northern light skylight and what it does for natural light. What we always love to do with a lot of our spaces is wrap it with greenery. And sometimes people don't always have the luxury of space, beautiful ocean views. But even if you just get like a glimmer of an area off to the side with a planter box and some greenery, it just adds so much to a space. So it's a big part of what we do in our work.
Let's start by you telling us a little bit about who you are and where you came from and what kind of got you to where you are now running your own architectural practice in Clovelly, and a little bit about Carla, who she is.
I grew up in Sydney. I have an older sister, Rebecca, and two beautiful parents. I'm very, very lucky to have been raised with such beautiful parents, and family life has led to the person that I am today. And that is someone with a good moral compass, I hope, strong values. And I was raised in such a stable family life, which I such a privilege. But I think that has, in the end, allowed me to really push myself in all areas of my life. So not to say that I was a fantastic student and I got straight A's all my life. I worked really, really hard. And I think my parents, my mum is a school teacher, and obviously education comes first and always has been, but they've always both had their own businesses. So my mum is an art teacher, had her own business. My dad's in transport, had his own business. So growing up in our family life, I watched my parents have their own businesses and companies and just work really hard. And whilst family always came first, they always showed up to everything. We had a really great family life. So I never, ever felt like work was always at the forefront. They juggled it so well, and lots of nights I could see them working till all hours of the night. And I think just being around that, I said to my sister and I that they wanted us to do our own business. But I just think through osmosis and absorbing not only the male role model in your life, but also the female role model in your life, start a business and have the tenacity and the excitement. Like, I watched my mum just love her business, and she loved having growth and she loved being involved in it. Like, there's a lot of other areas that led me to have the confidence to start my own practice, and I'm happy to touch into that. But I think that was the kind of baseline childhood scenario that I was always surrounded by.
Entrepreneurialism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did you say your mum was a school teacher and then she started her business?
Yeah. So she also specializes in art. So she started her own art business teaching kids. And I think as well, being raised surrounded by art and a creative teacher meant that, you know, I always heard her say to all her students, you know, no mistake is a bad mistake. It always leads to something fabulous. And in creativity, you have to have a safe environment. So she taught art and always encouraged her children, who were always amazing, award-winning. She just would wipe out Kids Art Express every year because all of her kids just would win awards. And it came from her nurturing state as an art teacher to make sure everyone felt safe when you're being creative. So that's definitely had an imprint on me and my creative career. Definitely towards the end, I can delve into the School of Architecture and how I think that damaged my confidence. So that's quite a toxic, highly critical. We'd have design studios and you'd have to design a building and pin it up, and you'd have a row of very elite architects from your industry just critique you and tell you everything that was wrong with it. So just to survive the School of Architecture and be able to deal with that level of critique is extremely tough. There is such a, in my time during studying architecture, there was such a high dropout rate of architecture because it's just so tough to get through, and that inner resilience. I think I definitely had that baseline with my family to be able to get through that. That's very easy for me to critique the School of Architecture, but it has put me in good stead to be able to sit in front of a client and present ideas and have that experience to know that every idea and every decision that you make in architecture has to have a very good reasoning behind it. You have to have a good explanation about certain decisions that you make for the design, because it's somebody's home and it's somebody's space that they're paying a lot of money to craft, and you better have a good reasoning behind your decision making.
Was that the kind of mentality of the architecture school, that that was why they were being so hard on you, that they acknowledged that that was a school of hard knocks?
I don't know. It's a very good question. I'm sure it is. Looking back as well, the first 3 years of architecture, whilst you're not actually doing architecture, only takes in retrospect now that I look back, they were really crafting our minds in how to understand space and how to make space. So we would such abstract models and chairs and spaces for artists. And it was trying to craft a very naive brain to be able to think three dimensions, which I am very grateful for that amount of training that I've had. And so it's very quick for me to critique the School of Architecture, but I'm sure there's some very clever people that have crafted how we learn and what we learn during that 5 years of university. But
yeah,
for me, I found the criticism side of architecture very tough on my personality, but I can see in retrospect how it has been fortuitous for my career.
It doesn't sound like that criticism piece is something that you experienced as a child growing up. That was not the model that you were shown.
No.
So how did you actually deal with that? What did that come at you like, and how did that shape the way that you studied and became a business owner yourself?
I think it's slowly met that every decision that I make in architecture is very well thought through. Even my decisions in business and within the practice is very well crafted and thoughtful for, because not only did I experience a high level of criticism, but then that inner voice within yourself can be highly critical too. I've had to really be self-aware about that and master that in. But it also comes with confidence, right? The more you have confidence in a skill, the more that that inner voice of critic gets less. So I think in time and with experience, that inner voice has led to good decisions. So I think it has been a blessing in the end, but it has meant that I've had to do a lot of work within myself to be able to push some of that criticism away and have that inner confidence within yourself.
Yeah. And I imagine in a field like architecture, which interestingly you're saying there was a lot of drop off, but it's still very competitive in a lot of ways, right? And I suppose even though you can define yourself with your brand and what your style is, do you feel that it's important to constantly be validating your skill set and your value system as an architect? Is that how you differentiate yourself in this kind of market? And how do you do that?
How we differentiate ourselves in this market is a really good question. And I think the more that I have learnt in practice now is coming back to my core values and believing in myself. And I think that comes down through my childhood and my upbringing. And I have done a lot of work. I've engaged Dr. Jodie Lowinger from Mind Strength, the Anxiety Clinic, and she mentors CEOs. And so we've done a lot of work together in crafting how I lead and how I work and how my mindset is in place. And so that always comes down to core values. So I think I'm always working and leading with values of, well, my personal values is always kindness, and how that manifests then into business in practice is you can't always be kind in business. It still can come through. I think I transfer the value of kindness when it comes to business to being fair and reasonable. And so then being fair and reasonable comes through in so many aspects of the practice. So when I sit down and have to design a space and I'm getting a brief from two partners in a relationship, and let's just say they're male and female, they have two very separate ideas about how they want a space, I have to be able to listen to both, think of a fair and reasonable response about how to design that so I can meet both of the needs. And then that comes through with council, it comes through with dealing with builders on site, making sure that builders are being paid a fair and reasonable amount and they have enough time to build. All of those values come through in every single decision and how we work.
Become part of your brand, I imagine, as well.
So kind of coming back to your question about how we differentiate ourselves, and I think that kind of does tie in with our brand. And when I did start, you can see a lot of our branding has lots of soft neutrals and a softness to it. So I wanted the kindness and the empathy and my personality to be very much intertwined with the brand and the way that we work. And that is to be extremely empathetic, but also very critical thinkers at the same time.
Which is quite a combination, right? Because in a way, you've got to be empathetic and listening to your clients and what their ideas are. And then you've got to give them back what they want, but potentially deliver them with something completely different.
Talk about
how the process works. I mean, it must be incredibly complicated.
I think a large part of it is, and this is what I've learned over time and I've received beautiful feedback from our clients, is so much of what we do and how I lead and how I converse with not only my team, but all of our clients and consultants and builders is listen. You have to listen and you have to be a very, very good listener. Well, when you learn that skill, you can really unlock your conversations with almost in any situation. And I always joke about this when it comes to when people ask what I do or when I try and explain our job to our team or any decision making. I think architects are just really, really high level good problem solvers. That's what we do. We do it on every level. When you're sitting down and you're trying to achieve a brief and you're trying to design something with two separate ideas from clients, you're essentially just problem solving. Then it also goes back to that experience that I've had about criticism and that every decision has a really good rationale behind it. And if you have a strong rationale and you can explain that rationale, the solutions to the problems are very clear. So for example, we had a house where the clients had three children. They wanted to maximize as much space as they could. They gave us a brief, but they also wanted to have lots of natural light and they didn't like how dark the existing house was. As I'm planning and as you like sketching out different bedroom here, bedroom there, oh no, the bathroom won't work there. I want the natural light to go into that space. So I'll move. It's a bit like playing with Tetris and you're moving spaces around and you're micro problem solving as you go. And so I know that space won't work there. So I'll move it there, but then I need to put this space there because the northern light's coming from this. And then they want the indoor-outdoor connection. And then I need to get the stair in somewhere. So it's all these like little micro problems that you are making, but you have really good rationale about why they're moving or changing. And so I designed this space with a courtyard in the middle. Clients come to you with like real estate mindset after they've bought a property, like let's maximize bedrooms and let's jam in as much space. The site was south facing. So I knew in the middle of the house, it was very, very dark. So I had to put a courtyard in the center. I could sit there and I could see one side of the couple be like, that space is a perfect bedroom size. Like we can't just put a courtyard in there. And so I knew rationale wise already after I had designed it, that that space was empirical to be able to dispel natural light to either side of those spaces and draw in the northern light. And it was an easy, or had already foreseen that that question was going to come up by the client in that meeting, and to be able to say, well, I did this for this, this, and this reason. And that was easy for them to understand. So I think just having a good rationale for your solutions is really important.
Yes. And I think as you're talking to me, then I'm imagining, you know, it's quite easy for you to see very clearly a solution. And yet, like you're saying, the objective of the client can be quite different initially, at least. They want to maximize their kind of real estate value and you're trying to maximize their light. How do you kind of come together and almost show them the light, show them your way? How does that work in, as a process for you? Because that is very much, you know, what I would call a leadership quality, a skill, a special skill, actually. And like you say, obviously it comes down to listening, but at the base of it, you're doing something that they haven't necessarily known that they needed. So how do you pose that and how do you get that across the line?
It's so tricky. Also really need a high level of IQ too in that moment, because you really need to be understanding the point of view of the client and where they're coming from to be able to answer it. And so it's very different for all different situations, but for that situation, I knew the way that I could explain it was always communication. How do you communicate it? Because different clients are either driven by visuals or numbers or diagrams. So I knew in this case, the clients were driven by dark images. So it was a matter of just communicating in the way that that client could understand it. And that was lots of different precedent images to be able to explain how it would look and how it would feel to them. But it's very difficult. But there is a very big layer of trust that comes when you have to engage an architect. And I always encourage that when clients meet with us and also they're embarking on this process, is that you need to work with an architect that you trust.
I want to get onto that, but I do want to just cover off, you know, it sounds like you're part architect, part psychologist. It's quite important in senior leadership positions to have a high level of EQ and be able to manage your client without being someone that gives themselves away. And how's that balance work? Is that something you've learned from negative experiences, hard experiences, or is it something you've had innately from birth? What do you think?
It's so funny. Coming onto this podcast, I've been thinking so much about what type of leader I am, what type of leader I think I am. So I can tell you what leader I think I am and what leader I think I would like to be, but I actually threw it back at the team and they said that I'm a leader with a lot of empathy and a high IQ, and but also at the same time a very critical thinker, which I was just like blown away by, and it's exactly what I had hoped I was as a leader.
Tick.
And how much of myself as a leader since getting that feedback from my team is nature or nurture, right? How much of that is something that I have learnt over time or is innately in my personality? And I think it's both. It's innately in my personality. When I look back in my childhood, I know my mum's always said that I was quite happy to play on my own. So my sister's like this Sagittarius, super vibrant, needs social interaction and people around her. Whereas I was quite happy to always go and play in my room on my own with my own toys and make my own decisions. So I've always had that inner confidence within myself about the decisions that I make and what I want to do. So I think there's always that baseline about me that's nature. And I've just slowly crafted the skill based on experience to be able to make those decisions and being those meetings with clients when you're trying to, I like to say, hold their hand through the process. Like it's quite an intense process and it's quite intimidating, particularly those clients that can't read a drawing and you're sitting there presenting a drawing to them and you're trying to show them. They're just seeing all lines. Like you're trying to explain all these really complex spaces and they're just seeing a bunch of lines.
I think it's really interesting how you you're kind of talking on the really having to read the room, and especially if you've got a couple or someone who's in a relationship, the intensity around decision making and compromise is probably much higher than it would be in a business environment where the stakes are lower, let's say. But has there been any situations that you can kind of recall that have built this experience, this leadership style, this management that you can recall along the way that have really shaped who you are and how you've approached things? Like, were you doing things in a particular way that you had a certain experience? You're like, okay, that has got to change. I've got to change my approach in order to make things work better in the future.
No, I can't recall any situations. I just think they're small experiences throughout the period of running your own practice. And I spent 5 years studying architecture. And then I spent another 5 to 6 years learning from within the industry, learning and watching how other practices, or I placed myself within small practices because I always had a passion for residential architecture. I didn't really like the larger practice. I worked for some amazing architects and watched how they led, how they ran a business, and how they designed and worked with clients. So I took little bits from the three practices that I did work for, and I think that's definitely shaped the way that I practice today. I also had like a very traumatic life experience when so 3 years ago, my husband had a cardiac arrest, and I found him. It was during COVID. He was doing a workout in the backyard, and I found him, and he was very, very unwell. And I performed CPR on him for 10 minutes and I saved his life. So whilst there was a lot of magic on that day, so I'm very conscious of, you know, a sudden cardiac arrest not going to in the direction that we luckily had, and which Chris is very well and alive today. So within that moment and since that day, I've obviously had a lot of therapy and to overcome such a traumatic event. But what I've learnt and how that has manifested in my practice and as a leader is that I was able to prove to myself that with all of that criticism and all of that hardship that I went through as a young architect, being able to witness myself do and perform such an incredible thing is just so empowering. And it was so confidence boosting. And I know it has had such a great effect on me as a person and my confidence and the way that I practice architecture and the way that I lead. Whilst I like to say you can do anything that you put your mind to. And in that day, I was lucky to have the outcome that we had because of lots of other magical factors. But I still truly believe whatever you put your mind to, you can make magic happen, is that you just have to have that tenacity.
Yeah, it's interesting you use that word tenacity, because just hearing you speak about that situation, I have heard you speak about that before, and it makes the emotion, I could see you getting emotional. I'm like holding back the tears as you're talking about it, but it's really the breadth of it, not just in your personal situation, but in the moment of life being so fragile in a way that it could go two different ways. And obviously that's a very extreme situation, but I guess in terms of shaping your decision making around things, it makes things quite black and white, I imagine, where you kind of go, look, there's an option, I can choose it. Tell us how that's kind of led you. And obviously it's a hard thing to relate to a working situation, but you were talking about it building and changing you. Describe what's that's done for you in a work capacity or in a personal work capacity.
From a personal capacity, I have great perspective on life. This is standing in ICU with my husband, very unwell that evening. And someone said to me, oh, this will be a gift in the end to you and your husband. And I wanted to throw him across the room thinking, this is no gift, like this is hell. It actually has been the greatest gift for myself, my husband and our family. We don't sweat the small stuff. We value family. Everyone says it, family first. And we really had a moment in our young life to really value of family and love and how important that is. When it comes to practice and work, I think, yes, I have the ability to see very, very quickly and clearly black and white. And whilst that's quite clear in my mind, I have to be very careful about how that gets communicated with clients, because a lot of their brains aren't in black and white. And I did have a client that struggled with decision making and said they would be hard pressed to make a decision within a year, let alone a moment on site when I can quite quickly make a decision on site within, you know, 30 seconds. I have to be really respectful to those that can't do that and might find that my skill and my ability to do that can come across as though I haven't thought about it properly, that it's rushed. So you have to be really mindful about how other people make decisions. And sometimes, so for example, we're working on a project at the moment. We presented the concept design. There's lots of reasonings why the rationale and the shape and form of the design has come to where it is. And we have a process after presenting the design where what we call design development, where the client can put some input in, make some changes if there's some areas they're not sure about. So we got like an email with a long list of changes, which is success. We were happy. And so many of those I'm very happy to say this won't work for this and this reason. But sometimes it's making those changes as part of the process and showing the client what it comes to oftentimes I'll be like, oh, but I just think I'd like to revert back to what you did and I want to do the concept. So it's sometimes part of the journey of the decision making that they need to go through. Rather, no one wants to be told what to do. Like, come on, we're mothers here. You can't tell your toddler, do this. I tell you, sometimes they have to learn for themselves and kind of walk the walk. So we find that sometimes in the practice and as part of the process is to allow the decision making to take those few steps, and we never say we told you so.
I can imagine the communication piece and actually being able to deliver, you know, results, communicate those results, the designs is very tenuous. You've got to be very careful. You're probably giving away a lot of the ownership of those designs. That was your idea the whole time. What a fantastic idea you had all along. Talk us through your communication style as a leader. I mean, you lead a team of, it was a practice of five. So you've got people that work for you of all different stages in their careers. Yeah. And obviously you've been mentored by people in previous practices that you've worked at. What are some of the communication tricks that you have learned along the way that you think have been very valuable to get you where you are now?
I have to thank Dr. Jodi a lot for her work in helping me shape the way that I communicate and also how I train and guide and mentor my team. I also see so many correlations with parenting and what I talked about. No one likes to be told what to do. And I noticed Dr. Jodi does this a lot with me with our sessions, and she'll kind of tip her head and say, what do you think? And in that moment, she knows you know the answer. And it's part of the brilliance of her as a CEO mentor is that she's trying to build the confidence. She knows, and I know I have the answer, but it's just a matter of having the confidence to really state what the answer is. And so I tried it. I've seen that skill in Jodi. And so, and she's also helped me try to emulate that with my team. So if we'll have a tricky situation on site and the team will come to me and say, this is the situation, these are some of the solutions, what do you think? And oftentimes I'll say, well, what do you think? And they'll have the answer. And I'm there just to essentially say, it's the right answer. You've nailed it. Or just through that process of having that conversation with me, they'll be able to come to better understanding of what their decision is. But you're essentially trying to build that muscle of decision making and communication as a skill. And it's definitely a skill and a muscle that you need to work on.
And I think, you know, married with a mind that works quite quickly, it must be quite the challenge, it sounds like, for you would be to slow down that process, not to, like you say, answer the question or make the decision, even if you see it. You know, the training for you is to kind of ensure that it lands. So how it lands from your perspective, you know the answer already, you might get there. It might take a week for that client to get there. You're going to have to manage that process.
There's a lot of patience. I have another client that says I have the patience of an angel.
And then trust. So all the while you're building, like you were talking about before, the trust piece in with the patience. Back to you being a psychologist as well as an architect. I think there's a second career option for you here if you wanted.
No, thank you.
You were talking about trust a bit, and I wanted to dig into that because I wanted to kind of talk about the process of onboarding a client from the pretty pictures on your Instagram page that obviously demonstrate the amazing work you do, but turning that follower, let's call it, into a client. It's not easy, is it? Because you've got build a long-term relationship with them, build a lot of trust. Talk us through some of those barriers to entry for your clients and how you can help solve those.
I'm very, again, empathetic to the step and the trust that is there from a client to engage an architect. It's a very big step. And I think from starting my practice at the very beginning, and it was solely myself as a sole practitioner, I think what helped me start the practice is my personality and my level of empathy and my understanding for the process and connection with clients. So I think whilst Instagram and and you've helped us understand, you know, there's the funnel and everyone sees all the pretty images, but when clients come through that funnel and start to engage and have an inquiry with us, it's really engaging with a client on a personal level. So getting to know them, them feeling like they get to know us and the team, bringing them into the studio, meeting them on site, meeting their kids, and that there is a personality behind CMA and that we really care and we've really got a strong care factor. And I think that is what I hope will be the special factor in us in the industry that is very, very flooded with some amazing talent and amazing architects for clients to choose from, is the fact that we listen and we really care.
And do you find that when people engage in an architect, they kind of know who they're going with, they've chosen you before they come to you, or do you find that it is a case of they're talking to a few different architects and that it really is about the performance, you know? And when I say performance, I mean how that connection works between the client and yourself. What's the state in which people are coming? Is there a variety of different situations?
I think the majority of our clients now, which I'm very proud to say, are looking at a bunch of architects. And whilst from a sales and business point of view, that might not appear as though it's a good thing, but I actually think it's a great thing because a large amount of the architects that they're looking at are people that I strongly admire and have put on such a high pedestal. So I'm like, wow, this is an amazing opportunity that we're considered to be on par with some of these amazing practices that are in Sydney. I think it's a reflection on the client and their due diligence and their commitment to the process, that they want the best fit for their project and that they're doing their due diligence in sourcing that. I know personally for myself, I will chat to a few people when I'm sourcing some services. And I think it shows, yeah, a level of acumen that is the type of client that we would love to work with.
And do you sometimes say no to clients? Like, how does it work from your side? Do you kind of know naturally sometimes you'll have a chat with a client and just think, I'm not going to be able to make this client's vision come to life, or the budget they have to put towards the project size is not aligned, or there are situations where you've built your confidence to the point where it's actually like you feel quite clear on whether there's a fit?
Yeah, absolutely. And feel very strongly about that for a few years now, that whilst the clients may not think this, but a large amount of the time when they're interviewing us, I'm interviewing them to see if they're the right fit for us and our practice. And so there's a few kind of buzz questions that I know that I would like to ask, you know, what kind of project of ours do you like? So it means that they're quite engaged with CMA and they're coming to us because they want a particular type of project or style. They like the way that we present ourselves, rather than just trying to source an architect or a service as quickly as possible to fit a solution.
The fact that you can do that is a level of confidence that you have, you know, to be able to say no or to pass on things knowing that it might not be the right fit for you. I mean, obviously, you know, there's the beginning of a business. How many years through CMA are you now, and where would you say you are in the phase of the business cycle?
Yeah, so we're coming up to 9 years now. Early in the practice, I would have taken on all projects and not had the privilege to be able to sit back and think, is this the right client for our practice? So it's really nice to be able to reflect on it now with you, actually, because you just have to just take all the projects that you can get to be able to build the portfolio and to show your skill. So yeah, it's really special to be able to do that now.
And do you think that in 9 years you've seen, you know, the business change a lot over that period, or do you, you know, the key learnings that you've learned that have taken you and got you to this level? Or do you think the mere fact that you saw that your family could make a business success, you knew you could make success yourself? 9 years is a great achievement, and obviously.
Yeah, no, it hasn't been easy. It's lots of hard work. I think the personality that I am, I'm always a half cup full person. And so I joke about it, and I've had lots of sessions with Dr. Jody about it. I'm an extremely aspirational person. I'm always looking for the next thing. I'm always like a sponge trying to absorb information and learn, and never feel like I have anything down pat. Like, I don't feel like I've got architecture or business or leadership down pat. I'm always really keen to learn and expand how I do things. So there's an ambition there that I joke with Dr. Jodi is like a striver's curse. Mm-hmm. I'm always striving, always striving, always looking to push in the next direction or look or refine or do something better. I don't necessarily think it's a curse per se. It's just who I am and what I take on as a person and what I'm pushing and striving for has always served me well to this point. But I think I have learnt over the years, because there was such a period there, particularly after Chris's cardiac arrest and being the primary earner, wanting to make something of my practice and make it into a successful business. So I got to a certain point where I think I burnt out quite a lot. I was doing everything. I had the CEO hat on, the accounting hat on, the practice manager hat on, the architect, the graduate. I was doing everything. And it, luckily during COVID and the boom, I had an ability to have enough cash flow in the practice to start delegating and employing some amazing team members on the team and starting to just literally delegate every part of my life. But at that peak, when I started to get really overwhelmed and really burnt out, I was like, I need to do something about this. So there was also an ambition in myself to reflection upon myself to learn that I need to look after myself as a leader first and foremost, otherwise this is all just going to crumble around me. So I need to, what does that involve? And that took a lot of time. That meant, you know, employing professionals in their area to help support me. And it meant little things like getting a personal trainer, engaging Dr. Jodi to help with my mindset and allowing me to make better decisions. Because when you get in that state of overwhelm as a leader, you're not leading. You're just like putting out fires and just rolling through the day to day. And then I also, through like different fortuitous avenues, had the late great Tim Brown teach me how to meditate a bit over a year ago now. And he teaches transcendental, also Vedic meditation. And so I just thought, oh, meditation, like wellness, do personal training, all of this wellness to make sure. But meditation has been a profound thing to my leadership skill, because Tim would talk about, you know, we'd go for walks and he'd say, see that amazing huge tree, that root system underneath that tree is so deep and pushed so down deep inside itself to be allow that tree to kind of go and extend that far and be as beautiful as it is. So he's like, Carly, you need to pull back. You need to come back within yourself and look after yourself to be able to allow that to flourish. And it just made so much sense to me. And I've been able to see the benefits of meditation and self-care within myself as a leader, within my practice and within the business itself. I see it. So my husband's in aviation and within the cockpit as a pilot. So there's typically four pilots. So there's the captain, the first officer, and then there's two second officers that sit behind. And so the first officer typically does all the flying. So does all the takeoff, the landing, is basically busy the whole time doing all the stuff. And the captain is sitting there overseeing, essentially checklisting, reviewing everything, and he's there to dive in if things need that. And so I've taken that analogy with my practice. I needed to look after myself, rise above, allow the team to do their job and to have oversight myself to fill gaps or provide support where it was needed, rather than be in the business doing everything. It just wasn't working and it wasn't going to be sustainable for very long.
That's so interesting about the self-care piece. I mean, it's a very, you know, obviously big topic where a lot of people are talking and understand that it's something they need to integrate into their life. But the regularity of it, the meditation part is actually quite interesting, isn't it? The actual keeping coming back to something and doing it as a daily practice so that your mind, like you said before, it's a muscle, retraining this new muscle in a new way to change and adapt.
Tim would talk about it, you know, everyone would go on that yearly holiday and think, oh, this will refresh me. This will give me the energy that I need to kickstart for the rest of the year. And it's not, and people are burning out and you need, and that's what I love about this meditation is it's a daily practice twice a day. I do it in the morning before I go to work. And then I also do it in the middle of the day at about 3 o'clock. it launders all the processing that you're going through, and then you kind of come out of it and you feel like you haven't had a good session and you're critical of yourself. And Tim would be like, don't judge your meditation based on the meditation itself. Judge it on how you behave and how you feel afterwards. And I will meditate before I'm creative or where I have to do a concept design, and I'm blown away by what comes up out of the surface, or before I go into a big meeting and I've meditated and I have such a clarity of my thought. So I think it's really helped me as a leader for sure.
And how long? Just give us a little example of, is it like a 5 minutes, 10 minutes? What do you do? Is it breathing?
No, so you do 20 minutes twice a day.
Wow, that's commitment.
And so I'll kind of do the morning routine with the kids, and I meditate a lot in my car.
Can you do it while you're driving?
No. That's so unsafe, Mia.
So you get parked stationary somewhere and just...
Yeah, parked. So, because you go quite deep and you get quite a deep... If you are trained properly and you get given a mantra, 20 minutes of transcendental meditation is equivalent to 3 hours sleep. 2 days to train over a weekend to train me how to do it, and lots of upkeep to be able to tweak it and learn as you go. But yeah, you get into quite deep places of rest. And I think we're just, and I've learned it now, we're in such a stimulated world. We get stimulated by the people around us, the activity, social media, news, and to be able to, we don't, and our phones, we don't sit still enough. And stillness and being sitting with our thoughts, and I think as a creative, that has taught me so much, because I have learnt as a creative, it is the periods in between my life that aren't full of meetings and that aren't busy. So it might be the walk with my daughter to school, or driving in between meetings, or going for a swim, or going for a walk, that I often unlock problems or my creative thought, because it's the space in between. Whereas often we're like on our phones or doing something. I'm really in a process of enjoying that stillness and those moments in between life.
That's interesting. But then I feel, does life and personal and work then merge into one in a way?
Well, that's just my brain. And a lot of the time I'm always thinking about work.
Well, that I can imagine you are, because it's just it's one in a way, because you're creative. I know you just went on a trip overseas. Tell us a little bit of that, about that. But, you know, that was a holiday, but essentially it was a creative exercise at the same time. I imagine, I mean, you're using both sides of your brain, your left and your right, for business and creative.
Yeah.
Is that why you burn out, or do you think disconnecting from work is hard for you?
Yeah, I really love what I do. I really love architecture and I really love design. So I know it's cliche to say, it doesn't feel like work for me. It's a real enjoyment. But at the same time, yes, I'm very aware, and I have been very strict up until that point where I felt like I was getting to burnout. Don't work on weekends. I really try very hard after 6 o'clock when I walk out of the studio, and it's something that's also a big part of our culture at CMA too, where, you know, we're working from 9 till 6 p.m. every single day. That's plenty amount of time to get our job done from Monday to Friday. And there's a really toxic culture in architecture to do really late nights and do long hours. I'm not interested in that. I don't think you do your best work when you're overtired and you're just working all the time and thinking about it all the time. So I'm quite strict with my team to make sure that they don't do any overtime and we're working from 9 till 6 or whatever their hours may be, because we're quite open to flexible hours at CMA. But that's ample amount of time for us to do our jobs, and that we don't need to do overtime. So I'm very strict with myself and as a leader, to lead it as an example to my team, that around 6 o'clock we all go home and we spend time with our loved ones and we have a good rest, and then we come back and we're sharp and we work really hard during the period when we're on. It's the same with the weekend. But I think as a business owner and a leader, and I love what I do, I'm always thinking about work. And it's part of the responsibility that you hold when you make that decision to start your own practice. And yeah, definitely we had an amazing trip overseas last month. And thanks to my amazing team, I was able to switch off on the day-to-days. My mind was sparked with creativity. It was infused with so much exciting ideas. but I wasn't acting on them. So I wasn't like having to do a sketch. I know that they're going to my library in my brain and also training your eye. So as a designer and an architect, I feel like you need to get yourself out into the world. And whilst maybe you're not drawing a detail that you see when you walk past it, you're seeing it, you're educating your eye to be able to have, even just looking at the Pantheon in Rome, my eye felt so relaxed because it was all in proportion. Mm-hmm. I could see, I could feel the proportion, and it was smack on, and it was amazing and beautiful. But I didn't need to document that. It's just training my eye so that when I go to sketch or create something in space, it will also be of proportion.
What's your favourite part of being an architect in terms of the whole job?
Often the look on clients' faces when they're in the space and they're amazed and just so happy. It's so client-centric for me. It's making clients happy through the craft of something that I just have such a passion for and enjoy so much. So everyone says, oh, it must be so enjoyable to get on site and see your creations come to life. Yes, it is, but it's also to see the happiness in the client's eyes when that space comes to life, probably.
I mean, what's the average length of time that you're with a client? Probably at least a year, is it, from start to finish?
Oh, yeah, probably minimum 2 years.
Minimum 2 years. So you're really developing such a long relationship with them.
Yeah.
Do you feel that when people come to you, and obviously engage with you, they realize the length of time? I'm assuming you take them through the process and it's obviously known, but 2 years is a real commitment. It's a big commitment by someone that you don't really know that well. Talk us about how that kind of works for people.
To be honest, I'm not sure that they're aware of the relationship that forms out of the process. Yeah. I think they're aware of the timeline. People are very well versed about how long it takes to design and get a project approved through council, and then all the stories that you hear about how long it takes to build something. So they're very aware of the timeline. But I think a lot of clients are quite surprised about the relationship that we form and the closeness. You know, like when we were away in Europe, we timed it with some past clients of a house we did, and we met up in Rome and all of our kids met, and it was really special. That's what I really love about the client relationship, is that it turns into a friendship in the end.
That's an incredible testimony to your working practice. In terms of reflecting on your journey so far, do you think that there are some kind of key moments or key lessons you've learned that really have shaped, you know, where you are and how you've stuck in and seen the business through, and what are your plans? Where are you heading?
I think each project we do is not of a particular style. Obviously, there are some threads that you see through each project, and it looks like my hand has been placed over that project, but I'd like to see that each house is a reflection of the clients and a self-portrait of the clients that live in them with our guiding hand over the top. So I think every time a project gets completed, there are key moments within the practice of just reflecting where we started, and each project just gets better and better or different, or we're exploring different ideas and we're testing new thoughts. So in saying that, there's no particular big moments. There's lots of lovely little moments throughout the practice that I'm really proud of. Moving into our own space in Clovelly and doing that studio up and making sure that the practice and the culture of the team within it, so that I deliberately placed the practice in a shop front so that we're connected to community and we see the local guy that walks down the street and pops in and says hello with his dog, and we're connected to the community and people can wave and clients can pop in and grab a sample or a builder can pop by. And somewhere the ocean and the beach is a very big part of me as a person, and I love nature. And so to be able to see my team break at lunchtime and pop down with their bathers and go for a swim to have a break is just so lovely for me to see that they have that work-life balance. Yeah, having the studio and where it is and giving us that space and the ability to craft our own culture to be able to create our best work has been a really big proud moment of ours. Where we're going is very exciting. I have been a striver. I'm always striving for lots more, but I am also very careful in our steps forward. I really want to make sure that all of our systems and our practices as a small practice are very, very in ground, and that we've got all that really solid base. you know, you've seen and heard of businesses growing too quickly. And I really don't want to do that. I want to make sure that we're really tight and then slowly grow. So we have lots of plans. And I've also got some other plans and try and connect architecture to more of the middle market. I feel like it's definitely available to the aspirational and those that have worked very hard to be in a position that they are in. But how do we allow good architecture and good design available to people with all budgets and to not be that upper echelon of society? Because I've looked at, you know, Ray and Charles Eames, who designed lots of furniture in the post-war period, and they designed a lot of their furniture to be quite affordable and available so that good design was in everyone's home. It was available. And now, you know, a lot of those pieces are just so expensive and are one-off pieces that you buy in your lifetime. But I want to go to those core ideas to be able to allow design and good architecture available to the mainstream. So I've got some ideas to try and achieve that.
So what would you say to anyone who may have thought about engaging with an architect in the past and for some reason, whether it's money barriers or they feel their ideas aren't great or they don't have the right property or it's not going to work or they have time, building costs are too much. What would you say to dispel those, some of those fears and myths?
First of all, give us a call at CMA. Chatting to the professionals in the field of wherever you're wanting to take your project is the first piece of advice I would give. I don't think a lot of the industry understand architects and the nature of a registered architect and what our role is. I think there's so many variations of building professionals in the industry, and I don't think it's as well educated to the general public as it should be. To be able to call myself an architect, I've been registered with the Australian Institute of Architects. And so there's lots of building designers and all other people with different expertise in the industry. So just make sure you do your research when it comes to who you're engaging and therefore your expectations about the advice that you're getting. And it would be my recommendation to discuss it with a registered architect. There's lots of resources on the Institute of Architects website for people engaging an architect. Just be well educated about process and happy to guide anyone through that if they'd like to reach out.
Just as a kind of final question or statement, is there anything that you would say to aspiring leaders in your industry and the industry of architecture that you can kind of pass on as a piece of wisdom or advice?
Always lead with good values. Have a think about what your values are as a person and as a practice and try to always lead via that. And that's something that I practice every day, is always going back to my values and making sure that every decision I make is based on that.
Carla Middleton, it's been so great to have you on A Moment with Modern Mentors. Definitely gone behind the scenes with you, and it's been so amazing to just understand how it works in the world of architecture and what an incredible visionary entrepreneur leader that you are. And you've started your own practice 9 years ago and got big plans for the future. Really appreciate you taking, you know, time out to be on the podcast. Thank you.
Right back at you, Mia. Thank you. I admire you equally as much. So it's lovely. It's a great pleasure to be on.
Oh, that's been great to speak.
Make sure you subscribe to our channel and stay tuned for more episodes from A Moment with Modern Mentors coming your way soon.